Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today is a busy program, and I hope you will enjoy it very much. Part one will feature a look at history's most famous womanizer, Casanova. In part two, we'll be hearing from the executive producer of a fascinating miniseries on the National Geographic Channel, which envisions what a manned mission to Mars might look like in the year 2033. In part three, one of the country's most renowned travel experts will be talking about 1,000 places here in the United States and Canada that you need to visit before you die. And we'll finish out the hour by reminding you about some of the wonderful Christmas events that are going on this weekend, including the Sing-Along Messiah Sunday night, the final weekend of Mary Poppins at the Racine Theater Guild, a lovely performance by the Bell Ensemble of Racine, and the Kenosha Pops Concert Band's annual Christmas concert Saturday evening. All that and more coming up on today's morning show here on WGTD. We are talking for this portion of the morning show about a notable Italian by the name of Giacomo Girolamo Casanova. And of course, there are not many people in world history whose names become so synonymous with sort of a whole attitude and worldview as the name Casanova. And of course, as so often is the case, this is a famous person around whom a huge amount of myth has sprung up. But there actually was a real person named Giacomo Casanova, and he left behind him actually a rich literary legacy, including a detailed account of his own life. So historians like Lawrence Berggren have a lot to go on in trying to put together a rich portrait of just who he was and how he lived his life and the world in which he lived. So this new book is called Casanova, The World of a Seductive Genius. And Lawrence Berggren, an award-winning historian and biographer, has written a host of fascinating biographies, including of figures as diverse as Marco Polo, Al Capone, and Irving Berlin. That book is one of the best composer biographies I've ever read, actually. And I have thoroughly enjoyed this new book published by Simon & Schuster, again called Casanova, The World of a Seductive Genius. Lawrence Berggren, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here with you.
I'm really, really honored to be speaking with you, and congratulations on a really superbly written book. You say at one point early on, few, if any, writers or adventurers have documented themselves and their exploits as thoroughly as Casanova. And you tell us he did so most notably, I mean, in a whole host of writings, but in particular, a 12-volume history, which is the single most important source of information about him. Tell us more about him, about this work, and how it served you in crafting your biography of him.
Well, his memoir, which is, as you mentioned, 12 really fat volumes, covers his life. He was born in 1725 in Venice and died in 1798. He wrote it toward the end of his life, didn't quite cover everything, but crowded in a lot into this work. And it's both a social document of all the famous people he met and interacted with, everybody from Louis the 15th and Catherine the Great to all his seductions and amorous adventures and misadventures and criminal behavior and escape from prison. So you get a survey of Casanova and his times from high to low. So it's sort of like an extraordinary novel, really, of this man's incredible life. Now, we here in North America often think of Casanova as a kind of folkloric figure like Paul Bunyan or something, but in Europe, he's considered a major figure of the Enlightenment in the 18th century, a figure of liberation, of great intellectual sophistication, because he wrote tons of books. He wrote translations from Italian into from Greek into Italian of the Iliad. He wrote plays, polemics, any number of essays and poems. So he was a literary figure, and he lived in a time when there were a lot of what they called libertines, and he considered himself a libertine. And he also lived in a time when people wrote an unbelievable amount of letters and memoirs. If there was a dinner party, everybody would go home and write letters to people they knew about what had happened at that dinner party. So Casanova was, although he sounds today like, you know, an extraordinary exception, and in some ways he was, because he was a genius, he was typical of his times with his promiscuity and his literary aspirations. He only became famous, really, after death, when these memoirs were published, in 30 or 40 years after he died. In his lifetime, he was mainly known as an adventurer, as they called it, a gambler, a womanizer, and kind of a ne'er-do-well. A few people who knew him well suspected that underneath all this there was an inkling of a genius, but that would have to wait for posterity.
One of the things you tell us in terms of making good use of this sprawling autobiography is that you return to the original manuscript as much as possible, because you tell us that a lot of the flavor and personality of the original is lost when you start looking at translations.
It seemed to me, yes, because he wrote, it's kind of peculiar, he wrote in French, which was the sort of literary language of his time in the 18th century, and he was in Prague at that time as a librarian at the end of his life, in reduced circumstances, and so had lots of time on his hands to recapture the past. And it was kind of a Proustian exercise. And yet his French was, because he was from Venice, Venetian inflected. So it seemed to me. So it was very distinctive, and it wasn't standard. I found it fairly readable, and it was also funny. It was ironic. It was amusing. It had original ways of saying things. It seemed to me, and again, it's just my own opinion, that the various translations I've read, and there are several English ones, some of which are pretty complete, nothing until very recently covered everything, kind of, it's partly just the nature of the language. They kind of miss the humor and the irony, and, you know, English is a much more literal, concrete language, so you're kind of missing out on some of the sort of fun, ironic quality of his French. I did a lot of my own translation in the book to sort of capture his, kind of twinkle in his eye, if you will, as he was writing this stuff.
Right.
He was also a mathematical genius or near genius on top of this literary ability. And as I said, it makes him kind of an extraordinary figure. And he participated as well as he could in the intellectual life of his times. In the 18th century, there was a great, as you probably know, kind of upsurge in knowledge. It was the era of the famous Encyclopédie that was published in France, which was aimed to spread knowledge everywhere. It was almost like, you know, analogous to the Internet, you know, like a boom in information and knowledge that was accessible to everyone or almost everyone. So, you know, he was part of that movement or phenomenon. At the same time, he had this other life, always on the lam, in exile from Venice, trying to get out of jail when he was thrown into jail, seducing women wherever he went. Some people today call him a sex addict. It's funny, the other day I was reading an article about that term, and is it even a valid term? And many therapists said, no, it really isn't. It was kind of a term of opprobrium, and it's not addiction in the sense of being addicted to, a drug of some sort or some substance. It's another kind of behavior, and it raises the question of whether he was even compulsive about it. He said he had 124 lovers, more or less, give or take. you know, compared to some memoirs you read of people who were around today when they retire from whatever sports team they were on, that sounds like a rather modest number. And he was not unusual for his time, which was a time of great sexual freedom and experimentation. And, you know, he fit right in. And even Casanova had his limits. There's one section when he finally gets to Rome as a young person, he's invited to participate in an honest-to-God Roman orgy. And even he recoils. It's too much for him. There are too many writhing bodies. And that's not to say he shied away from experimentation or even multiple partners at the same time, but, you know, this kind of complete flat-out behavior was too much for him. And also he writes about it so well, and in some ways he's writing just about pure lust, and it's borderline pornographic. Other times he's writing about the most exquisite romantic feelings about certain women he was involved with. There was one called Henriette, a name that he gives to her. We don't really know her real name, although there are some good guesses in my book about it, which are, you know, incredibly refined, delicate, sophisticated speculations about the nature of romance. You know, the last line in my book is a question, what is love? And it seemed to me those three words kind of summed up the meaning of his life. It was an attempt to answer that question. And there are many answers. There are many different kinds of love, and he appeared to be determined to, sample or experience all of them. Some of these loves were fairly conventional, and others were, you know, would strike us as being, well, even blasphemous. For example, Venice at that time was a center of sex tourism. There's no other way to put it. It was the most depraved city in Europe, and tourists came from all over, especially from England, to sample the wares of not only Venetian courtesans, but Venetian nuns. They say, how is that possible? It's because the nuns were not really nuns in our understanding of it. They weren't in a convent for a religious vocation. They were confined by wealthy families who didn't want them to marry and dilute the family line. And they were kept in harems. And the people who supervised the harems collected a very nice fee from visitors who came to pay court on these young women who were confined. And every so often, they would have parties or orgies, and they had lovers. And Casanova writes about his escapades with especially two nuns, especially, who managed to escape, meet him for various assignations at night around Venice. I mean, it sounds very wild and romantic. And it was true because partly we have Casanova's word, but partly we have a lot of other accounts of other people doing very much the same thing. So he was one of a number of people who were, you know, participating or witness to that time.
Right. And you tell us that also that his memoir stands in contrast to, for instance, other memoirs from the same period that we might read in terms of the rich detail that he shares about not just himself and all of these romantic exploits about which he's so famous, but about the world in which he lived. And, of course, this is what makes him an especially valuable figure to someone like you and, for that matter, to all of us.
Yeah, I guess you'd call it a social historian. You'd call him a social historian because, you know, he had this incredible memory. He kept journals and diaries his whole life. He often kept letters that he wrote and copies of letters, and then letters that he received from various people. So he was able to document his life very well. But you're right. He had more detail and a larger cast of characters than practically anybody else of this era. And people have been aware of his memoirs for a long, long time. As it happened, when I finished my previous book, which was about Christopher Columbus's four voyages, and I was looking for another subject, I came across an item that the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, the French National Library, had paid the most they'd ever paid. It was nearly 10 million euros for the complete manuscript of his memoirs. And I wondered, what's the big deal? You know, why was that so important? Well, I found out. I was on a plane to Paris and went there and started reading through the manuscript myself, and which he wrote in his own hand. And now it's all online, by the way. If any of your listeners want to look it up, it's on GallicaCasanova.com, and they can see facsimiles of this entire manuscript, or anyway, a good portion of it, and also the very complete, freshly edited editions of it.
Interesting.
Have started, to be published. So I realized, he was really covering all of life. He left nothing out. He didn't censor anything. And he wrote things about famous people, Catherine the Great or Louis the 15th, or many Italian nobility that, could have gotten him in a lot of trouble, jailed or executed in his lifetime. He, in other words, he was spilling the beans, but he knew that it was, he was writing for posterity.
Right.
He was saying things that he couldn't say at that time, except gossip. And, he really fully participated in his times. It was interesting because he was not well-born. He came from the bottom of society. His parents were actors, which is, in Venice, was an social outcasts. His mother was a fairly famous actress/courtesan, and I tracked down a number of reviews of her performances around the continent, but he didn't have much to do with her. She left him when he was only 5 or 6 years old to pursue her career, and he was raised for a long time by his illiterate grandmother and then trained to be a priest, which at least gave him a solid grounding in education in Latin and philosophy and theology. So he remained intellectually engaged throughout his life.
And and in your book, you posed this question among several about him. How did this least loved, right, cast-off child become the most celebrated lover in history? And, of course, your wonderful book is probably right now the best way for us to explore that and other intriguing questions. The book, again, is called Casanova, The World of a Seductive Genius. It's published by Simon & Schuster, the author, Lawrence Berggren. Lawrence Berggren, I congratulate you on a superbly crafted and endlessly fascinating book, and I'm glad we could have a little chat about it today on The Morning Show.
Thank you very much.
I'm really glad we could talk.
Thank you.
The time is 8:27. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and part two of today's program is coming up in just a moment. We are going to be talking today on The Morning Show about Another World, an extraordinary series which explores the exciting possibility of us reaching this other world, namely Mars, a planet with which Earthlings have had quite a fascination for quite some time. I hope you have had the pleasure, as I have, of taking in a really intriguing series on the National Geographic Channel called, simply, Mars. But there's nothing simple about this project. It, in fact, really defies easy categorization because it is, in a really interesting way, a blend of documentary and scripted drama. And it essentially imagines what our first manned missions to the planet Mars might be like, what sort of risks they might entail, and what sorts of exciting possibilities they might uncover. It sets such a journey in the year 2033, so not that many years into our future. And I'm really excited to be able to speak with one of the executive producers of Mars, John Kamen, who has done all kinds of intriguing projects and has a shelf full of awards, including an Emmy, a Grammy, an Oscar, and he is certain to receive some awards for this latest effort as well, again called Mars, airing on Monday evenings on the National Geographic Channel. John Kamen, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg.
It seems to me that one of the great accomplishments in just getting this on the air is the fact that, as I said in the introduction, this is a mini-series, I guess we would say, that really defies easy summation or categorization. I mean, it's not does not fall neatly into any of the genres that we immediately think about with television. And it just seems like in this day and age, you don't find much programming like that. Can you tell us a little bit about the process of conceiving this program and getting it on the air?
Well, conceiving it, I'm not going to say it was simple, but we've always been drawn to space topics. It's a category of work that, for some reason, lots of roads lead to radical media for. We've produced work for NASA. We're working on different projects related to different science topics. And along came Mars. Elon Musk and the work that he's doing in SpaceX, a good friend of ours, Stephen Petronic, who happened to be writing a book on how we'll live on Mars. And we put the two and two together and realized that it would make six. It's an incredible journey in terms of science exploration today and the people who are preparing for a mission to Mars today. For that not-too-distant future that you mentioned earlier. It's an amazing concept to think of human beings living on another planet, but we've probably been imagining that for an incredibly long time. And speaking of Imagine, we went out to our partners at Imagine, both Ron Howard and Brian Grazer, to partner on this endeavor because it's as massive an initiative for television as it is a mission to get there and it's in itself. And the National Geographic Channel, with its own DNA in exploration, was a proud partner to support this project and recognize its potential.
How long did you have to wrestle with the notion of when exactly to place the events, the dramatized events of this series? That is, to come up with a plausible date in which people from Earth would reach out to Mars in this way. Do you recall much about that conversation and how you settled on the year of 2033 as the year of such a dramatic launch?
Yeah, we absolutely did. We a lot of the scientists will tell us that certainly there'll be missions to Mars well before that, unmanned likely. There are some that are predicting manned missions to Mars as early as 2027, 2029. We decided to just take it out a little bit further because, as we know, space is tricky and sometimes things get a bit delayed. So 2033, we thought, was a practical date to settle in on in terms of all the drama that we're building, as well as, of course, the science that's taking place on the ground today.
One of the driving themes of this series, and it gets driven home by several different guests who are sort of part of the documentary half of it, talk about how what may drive us to overcome all of the risks and costs of sending a manned mission to Mars is the fact that we may, in the not-too-distant future, actually desperately need Mars because of the damage that we are doing to our own home world. If there's anything that might be just ever so slightly controversial or not universally agreed upon by experts, it might be this really intriguing notion. Can you talk for a moment about this driving force behind your series, the notion of people from Earth actually needing what the planet Mars might have to offer to us?
Well, sadly, the dinosaurs didn't have a space program, and we might actually know a few of them today. The reality is that there are a lot of conditions and a lot of issues that we are faced as a species on this planet, and the concept of interplanetary species is the an overriding factor in the concept of the series. It seems incredibly strange to us today, but not all that different than the explorers of the past when they went across to the New World and had no clue as to what they were going to discover and whether there was, in fact, a new world. So we believe that the concept of exploration is one in which mankind will always pursue, and the need for it is possibly inevitable, but not necessarily the absolute. It's just a question of the opportunities that may face us, the learnings that we may gain from the mission, and space has provided that type of learning for as long as we've been sending astronauts to space. I noticed the other day that in the passing of our great John Glenn, they mentioned his pursuit of his final mission was in fact in preparation for a Mars mission, because it was determining some of the science and some of the impact that a Mars mission would have on human beings.
I know that a central inspiration to this series was a book that that came out, I believe, early last year called How We'll Live on Mars by Stephen Petranek. Tell us a little bit about that book, which I've not yet had the opportunity to see, and what sort of direct inspiration you drew from it.
Well, Stephen is an old friend, and he's I've heard him speak several times on many subjects related to science. He was an editor of Discover magazine at one time, and highly regarded by many because of his ability to write on difficult subjects or complicated scientific subjects and make them understandable to the average person. He was actually, the two of us bumped into each other at a holiday Christmas party, and I asked him what he was working on, and he said happened to be working on this book, How We'll Live on Mars. I said, that's funny. We've been talking to Elon Musk about how we're going to get us there. And in fact, he nodded and assured me he was probably the guy that would get us there. And one thing led to another. If you read the book, it's a fairly simple book based on a TED talk that he gave on the concept of how we'll live on Mars. And it becomes a very practical reality. He breaks it down in a very understandable way, in which you realize quite quickly this is possible, and laid out in many ways the framework for our mission.
Hmm. I think one of the interesting things about the way the dramatized portion of the series has played out is that this is a mission in which not all has gone according to plan. And, I mean, beginning with the descent to the surface of Mars, things begin to go wrong with the spacecraft Daedalus. They land in the wrong place and have to sort of battle their way to where they need to be for their base camp. And in the episode airing this week, which, of course, I've not yet seen, called Darkest Days, you are exploring not what happens when sort of a calamity befalls a mission, but just sort of the grinding reality of the isolation in which such astronauts would have to live and with which to contend. And I really appreciate that, because that is something that not necessarily is the stuff that riveting movies, science fiction movies, are made, but it is a reality that is going to be part of any mission like this. Talk for a moment about the exploration of that particular theme.
Well, in the earliest planning of the project, we brought in a lot of scientists into our conference room here. Ron Howard joined us, and Brian Grazer at one point, listening to some of the theories and some of the stories, and it became very evident that space is tricky, and there will be things that will go wrong, and understanding some of those things that will go wrong and trying to illustrate them became a focus, primarily because we don't want to make it sound easy. This is not going to be a simple mission. We've unfortunately witnessed plenty of space-based missions that have gone wrong in the past. This perhaps will be one of the most difficult ones ever pursued, and the likelihood of having to consider Plan Bs and what might happen, what might be needed, necessary, is part of the preparation of any explorer, and certainly any astronaut that signed up for this mission.
Right. And of course, what I'm saying is, beyond the calamities that befall a mission, is this episode explores what happens when an astronaut has to live in extended periods of in a sense, artificial isolation. And that's the kind of cost or risk that we don't think a lot about. We tend to think about explosions and other such sort of dramatic events. This explores another kind of risk that is sort of beyond our typical notice.
Well, isolation millions of miles away, living in very close quarters, is of course a major factor in the human condition of exploration. Again, amazingly, just last year, we all know that Scott Kelly spent that year in the space station specifically for that purpose. And the effects of both the distance and his ability to get along with his fellow astronauts on that mission was all part of early exploration or early tests of that factor of human isolation and the mental impact it would have as well as the physical impact.
Right. And, of course, many people read the headlines in early September when the SpaceX program by Elon Musk, who is a participant in your series, suffered a devastating explosion on the launching pad. And it is a stark reminder of the high level of risk that is involved. Do you think, though, it's plausible that we will willingly undertake such a high level of risk and try to send men and women to Mars?
I think it's absolutely plausible. It's a reality. This is the focus of all the people who are involved on this planet today, preparing for a manned mission to Mars. I think that there's been a tradition in space exploration that has constantly challenged everybody in terms of their science and their planning, and there have always been setbacks, but the determination of the scientists and the engineers that are working on a mission like this are it's quite extraordinary. They accept failure. They recognize its potential, and they prepare for it and plan for it every day. So the setbacks are enormous and sometimes devastating. I think that the reality for this mission is the commitment of all the folks that we're working with on planet Earth in preparation for this eventuality is what the series is about, but is also what we'll be witnessing over the next decade or so of continued pursuit.
Hmm. The miniseries Mars continues to air on the National Geographic Channel, and you can go to their website to explore more of this. You can even view full episodes that perhaps you have missed. And John Kamen, executive producer, thank you so much, and congratulations on the great work that you and your colleagues have done on this really remarkable series.
Thanks so much, Greg.
We have part three of today's morning show coming up in just a moment, and at the end of the hour, a little preview of several of the wonderful holiday events which are going on this weekend, despite Mother Nature's wishes to the contrary. You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. It is exactly 8:44. One book that you might think about getting for somebody you love during these holidays is a really terrific book called 1,000 Places to See in the United States and Canada Before You Die. And this is a follow-up to a similar book that lays out 1,000 important and interesting places all around the world. And it's a really intriguing book indeed, written by Patricia Schultz, who is well known for her superb writing as a veteran travel journalist who's written for a number of different magazines and journals, and including that previous bestseller, 1,000 Places to See Before You Die. Again, this book focuses on 1,000 places right here in the United States and Canada. And Patricia Schultz, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
I have really enjoyed looking through this. I wonder if you could just say a word about the relationship between the previous book and this particular book. In what ways are they similar, and in what ways are they different?
Well, the first book came out in 2003, and both these books are regularly updated and revised and kept fresh and relevant. And the first book was about world travel, daunting, a real challenge, but one I met with great gusto. I've been traveling my whole life. And it was so wildly popular that it was only minutes after it came out that we were already wondering, what do you do as a follow-up? I mean, you've talked about the world. Where do you go after that? So it was kind of a no-brainer that we did a 180, and we turned around and thought, look at America. Look at North America and look at what we have. And there simply is no other continent anywhere on this globe that is as jam-packed with possibilities and attractions and places of great historical and natural beauty. And so the USA and Canada chapter from the World Book became the foundation of this second follow-up book, and then I added maybe 900 more places to create this book, 1,000 Places to See in the USA and Canada, which really gave me the opportunity to kind of spread my wings and to give North America much more attention and to spend another 5 years. The first book took 8 to explore further. I mean, I had traveled a lot in the USA and Canada until then, but this gave me a very different focus, and, you know, there's nothing like a deadline
right
to get you up and out and exploring nonstop.
Right. Tell us more about the mechanics of assembling this list of 1,000 and what that process was sort of like.
Well, that's a great question, and I don't really have an answer, because it's very organic, and it's very much from the heart. And I know that my friends, those who dared to visit my apartment during that time, because it really was taken over by a book of this breadth, thought that I, you know, must have some kind of special Excel sheet or, you know, breakdown that each state gets so many, but it really, you know, you'll see that there are certain states that just lend themselves to a greater variety or number of attractions or must-see, don't-miss kind of places, and others maybe not so much, but the alternative is to have a team of, you know, 100 people who are out there combing, but instead this is just me. It's my voice. They're my personal favorites. Are they the only 1,000 places to see in the USA and Canada? Absolutely not. But hopefully a selection that will surprise a lot of people and inspire a lot of people to get you up and out to then, you know, add your own discoveries. Because, you know, it's always the places you kind of stumble upon along the way that sometimes turn out to be the highlight of your trip.
I meant to really painstakingly look through the table of contents to make sure that all 50 states are represented and all the provinces of Canada. At a glance, it appears that they are. In fact, do we have that sort of thorough saturation in terms of these two countries?
Definitely. I think that even tiny little Delaware and Rhode Island, you know, size is not everything. Do they have the same number per square mile or per capita? Then no, but I think there is, you know, just the early history of each of our states. And I think Delaware actually is the only state that, poor Delaware, that may not have a national park. But there are other states that more than compensate. I'm thinking of Utah. Utah is just rich with national. They're called the Mighty Five, some of our most beautiful national parks. So, yes, everybody gets their, you know, page in the book. Many get multiple pages in the book. It is over 1,000 pages. And Canada, there are a lot of the really far-flung territories up in the Arctic, et cetera, that may not get a whole lot of ink, as we say. But Canada, for the most part, is also well represented as well.
Absolutely. One thing that I think probably was a bit of a challenge for you was when it came to a state like, for instance, New York. It's not a matter of sort of trying to come up with a list, but rather having to cut it back from, I mean, you could write, obviously, and many books have been written with just all of the things to see in New York City itself, and to figure out which ones belong in a book like this.
And that's not talking about the rest of the state, because it is my home state, and I grew up outside of New York City. So I'm aware of how much history and natural beauty. It's just an incredibly beautiful state. The Adirondacks is massive. I think it's the size of a state in itself in upstate New York. And the Hudson Valley, which is so rich in history, Henry Hudson, 1608. We all grew up, you know, learning about these early chapters in our American history all along the eastern seaboard. So, yes, it is. There are states. California is another one, Massachusetts, great natural beauty, great cities, large and small, great history. So it was a challenge, but that was a great part of the fun of this book, of trying to make sense out of, you know, you have so many pages and so many slots here. We've got 1,000. Who's going to make it? But in each entry alone, there often is so much that's merged and fused and condensed, so that in one entry, you'll find sometimes many, many, many different, you know, some are a trail. We have the Art Trail, for example, in New York State, or we have the Missions Trail in California, so that within one entry, you'll find a whole lot of places to keep you busy in one trip alone.
Right. And another thing I really appreciated about the book was that I feel like one of its greatest values is that, on the one hand, it reinforces what might be sort of the central legacy of a particular state, like Wisconsin, where I live now, or Iowa, where I grew up, or wherever we might be talking. But it also is a book that reminds us that generalizations and simple summaries do not spell out what a state is all about, and that there are states that we might think of as entirely rural that have beautiful spots of sophistication and so on. I mean, you really help us understand the rich and fascinating complexity of our country.
Yeah, and, you know, even as a professional travel writer and even as somebody who's been traveling, my earliest memory ever, I was 4 years old and I was in the back seat of the dilapidated family station wagon, and we were going off to Atlantic City, woohoo, someplace as exotic as the Jersey Shore. But I've been traveling regularly, and I've traveled around the world so that I see in a different context what we have here in America. And it just astounds me that Americans who can travel, we can travel, so you don't have a passport, so you don't have, you know, 6 weeks of vacation, but what we can see in the course of just a few hours or one tank of gas or just a long weekend, and yet people choose not to. So hopefully a book of this kind will really open people's eyes and perspective and really encourage people to get up and out, because there is so much to see, if not just in your state, then in your neighboring states. And that great cross America road trip is something that we really owe to ourselves, that the kids or your best friend or put the dog in the seat next to you, it doesn't matter. But to explore America from behind the wheel is an experience that is worth $1 million that you'll never forget, that is such an education in so many different facets and ways. And you really owe it to yourselves. And I think our politicians should travel more. I think that families should, you know, oh, the kids are too young, they won't remember. Yeah, they will. And you will. And it's an experience. If not, you know, they may not remember where you stayed overnight, but they'll have impressions and they'll have memories. And it's a life memory that are some of my most important to me, you know, as I move along in years. My earliest memories with my family, they're invaluable. And how you see yourself in the world and what you want to do with your life, and how you see America in the context of the world also is very important.
1,000 Places to See in the United States and Canada Before You Die is published by Workman Publishing. Patricia Schultz, the author. Patricia Schultz, thank you so much. Best wishes. Happy traveling.
Yeah, thank you very much. The same to you.
Bye-bye. And the time is approaching 8:55 here on WGTD. We want to finish out the hour by just reminding you of several of the marvelous holiday events that are going on this weekend here in the Kenosha Racine area. And as far as we know, they are all still going on, even though some snow is moving into the area. So, of course, do take plenty of precautions if you do choose to take in one or more of these events. But these are all very special. One presentation, a series of two performances, is by the highly regarded Bell Ensemble in Racine under the direction of Nick Baruti. And their concert tonight and tomorrow night is called An Old-Fashioned Christmas. This group is absolutely marvelous. Everything they do is first rate. And they are doing their two performances in two of the loveliest performance spaces here in southeastern Wisconsin. Tonight at Holy Communion Lutheran Church up in Racine, and tomorrow night at St. Matthew's Episcopal Church in downtown Kenosha. Both of those concerts by the Bell Ensemble and Old-Fashioned Christmas begin at 7 p.m. No admission charge. A free will offering will be taken, and all proceeds will go to underwrite the work of the Hospitality Center in downtown Racine. We want to remind you that this weekend is the final weekend of performances of the Racine Theater Guild's magical production of the musical Mary Poppins. Mary Poppins really flies, and that's not the end of all of the onstage magic. There is a performance tonight, performances tomorrow and Sunday as well. And you can call 633-4218 if you want to reserve your ticket to enjoy Mary Poppins at the Racine Theater Guild this weekend. We want to remind you that Saturday night at 7 p.m. at Siebert Chapel on the campus of Carthage College is a free Christmas concert by the Kenosha Pops Concert Band. Many of you enjoy their performances all summer long, but there is nothing like hearing them in the magnificent acoustical space of Siebert Chapel, a room just made for a group like the Kenosha Pops Band. And this is a concert that is put together with the enjoyment of the whole family in mind. Admission is absolutely free and open to the public. And again, the Kenosha Pops Concert Band's Christmas concert will be Saturday evening at Carthage College at 7 o'clock. And one thing I'm particularly excited about is I will be playing the beautiful Cassavant pipe organ, which celebrates its 40th anniversary. I'll be playing it on this piece called Leroy Anderson's Christmas Festival. Again, that concert is Saturday evening at 7 p.m. in Siebert Chapel on the campus of Carthage College, the Kenosha Pops Band, under the direction of Craig Gall. And certainly, last but not least, Sunday evening at 6 p.m., it is the annual Sing-Along Messiah at First United Methodist Church in Kenosha, right on the corner of Sheridan Road and 60th Street. This is part of the highly regarded Fine Arts at First series. Admission is absolutely free. The audience sings the choruses, and we have plenty of copies of the score to lend out if you don't happen to have your own. But please come and be part of this. We have a wonderful orchestra on hand and a sterling lineup of soloists who will be on hand as well, including the young bass who has regaled us with solos for the last couple of sing-along messiahs. Mike Anderley will be back to sing, among other things, the stirring aria, The Trumpet Shall Sound. Again, this is Sunday evening at 6 p.m. at First United Methodist Church in Kenosha, the annual Sing-Along Messiah.